I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Tom Romero. He's executive director of the Northern Rio Grande National Heritage Area, and David Lindblom. He is director, cinematographer, editor of the film Land, Water, People, Time. And he teaches at Northern New Mexico College, where he's also creative director of the TV station there, Canal 6. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Hey.
Thanks for having us.
Now, this film, Land, Water, People, Time, is screening on June 15th, this Friday, at El Museo Cultural, and there's a whole evening associated with it. There's a reception at 6, and then a film screening, and then a reception after that to talk about it and just kind of hang out. Let's talk for a moment about the Northern Rio Grande National Heritage Area. What's that all about?
It's an organization. It's actually an area of land. It includes Santa Fe, Taos, and Rio Riva counties. The area was designated as a National Heritage Area in 2006 by Act of Congress. And the organization that I work with, which is the Northern Rio Grande National Heritage Area, Inc., was designated in the law to manage the development of the National Heritage Area concept. And what it's about is conservation, preservation of the culture, the heritage, the language, and the environment of this area. There are 49 National Heritage Areas throughout the United States, mostly back east. And the whole purpose is to have a community involvement in areas that are relatively, I hate to say it, relatively unique, but you know, where there is a culture or a language or something in the history that sets it aside as part of the history of the United States. So that's what it's about.
Do you have any ability to actually preserve land or direct the way land is used?
The mission actually gets into working with local communities, working with local governments, working with individuals, but it does not enable us to go out and, say, like the Trust for Public Land, where they actually go out and buy up land or whatever. We're actually prohibited from doing any real estate type of transactions because they want to preserve the individual property rights. So we work with them. For example, I've been working with the community of Chimayo in some of their planning, and we've worked with Espanola and other places to try to develop properties that are part of the culture,
like what?
Or the history. For example, we have a grants program. We gave money away over the last 3 years. We've provided funding for a number of projects, like the Pinto Bean Museum,
which
no one knows it exists, but it's in Edgewood, which is in the southern
edge. For real?
Yes, in the southern edge of Santa Fe County. So we have provided them funding to get started to do an enclosure for that. We're helping in the restoration of La Sala in Galisteo, which is a community building, which they've been working on for a couple of years, and we've provided funding. We've participated in San Miguel Mission. So those types of conservation efforts. And then further north, we have done things like a Tewa language project with Santa Clara Pueblo, a farm project with San Ildefonso, a work with the Espanola Schools, Site Steward Foundation, a lot of educational types of programs, as well as funding the development of this film, which presents the culture in northern New Mexico. So it's a variety of things. We are funded partly by the National Park Service and from private donations and from contributions from local governments and state governments.
Let's talk about the film. You developed the project, this film, Land, Water, People, Time. How did this come together? Are you a New Mexican?
Yes, I grew up here and but went away to work in film. I worked in San Francisco and in New York. And in New York, I actually had an opportunity to work with Martin Scorsese for a little while. I was very, very homesick always. And I was just thinking about that the other day and realizing that some of the people that I kind of got were people from the islands, like Puerto Rico and these places in the Caribbean, there are lots of those communities in New York City. And I just realized that I kind of understood them because they too were really, really homesick.
So, oh, isn't that so interesting?
So I needed to come back and then fell into, well, there's a lot of filmmaking going on here. And Danny Valerio, who I met here when I got back, he was in touch with Northern Rio Grande National Heritage Area. And we started thinking about making a film about the three counties. And we themed it around water. And Danny had this idea of the cycles of the water. It starts with the snow, and the skiers use it, and then the rafters use it, the farmers use it, and everybody very much depends upon it. And there's this whole vast region that's the Rio Grande goes through, and all the tributaries and all the villages. And it's just, as soon as we had that concept, we knew how to do this film.
The thing that's beautiful, there's a lot of beautiful things about the film. It's very well made and well edited, and there's a lot of visuals, both contemporary and historical footage, or mostly still photographs, in it. And there's some real old-timers who speak with a lot of depth about this area. And I was thinking about, as a filmmaker, the process of drawing people out and getting them to speak on camera, particularly who are probably not used to doing so, that's a challenge.
Well, it is, and I don't know exactly why, but I think that we actually, it just happened. It just flowed that way. Sometimes, you know how you can say how much you like something, whether it's anything at all, and you might feel a little embarrassed saying it, and you don't really know if other people have that kind of unbridled attraction to something, and you're always a little embarrassed. Well, I think somehow we gave people an opportunity to talk about how much they revere this area in all its dimensions. It's just the physical beauty, the historical beauty, just the uniqueness of it that Tom spoke to, and somehow, and I don't really know for sure, people just talked about it. It came out really well.
Yeah, there's some really young people, like a boy who's running around the apple orchard explaining everything, who's extraordinary.
Yeah, that was just magical. That we see his. Well, I think he's about 7 years old at the time, and he considers himself a farmer.
Right, exactly.
And his grandfather runs an orchard in Velarde, and that's really important to see that the young people will step into the farming, because it's so hard. It's not really supported in a large scale way because of
Well, that way of life has been decimated, really. And the acequias system is not, I mean, it's still there, but it's not the core of life the way it used to be. And you know, the cash economy has basically taken a culture and fragmented it, and that's what we've got left, fragments, some of which are very beautiful, and some of the aftermath is quite ugly, like all the addiction and stuff like that, which we see in northern New Mexico, too. But when you think about preservation, like, this is something that I think is really a fruitful discussion to have after a film like this. What should one preserve? Why are you preserving it? Is it still a living thing, or is it more like an archaeological thing?
Well, part of, you know, that's a great discussion for sure, and part of what we get into in some of the discussions after the film and then ongoing are... you know, what the need is up there. There are people who are very much involved in the preservation of archaeological artifacts. There's the Mesa Prieta, for example, the petroglyphs north of Española, and the land. All of that is always important, and that is done. But the culture, when people talk about the culture, and this is what drew me to this particular organization and their mission, similar to what we were trying to do with El Museo when I worked there, the culture itself is not defined by dead things. You know, it's something that is living. And the honoring of that, like this little boy, is truly the star of the film. And I'm glad that you picked up on that as well. People love it because he is the embodiment of the living culture in the Rio Grande Valley, you know, where they are growing, you know, their trees and producing fruit and then learning how to do it from one generation to the next. There are a number of examples of that. And that culture has to be preserved in that sense. It has to be allowed to retain some of its old flavor, the language, the way people look, the way that people are toward each other, that type of thing, and at the same time supported in their economic endeavors. And so some of this, for example, the skiing, you know, the industry, that does support a number of people. There are a couple of hunters. It's ways of life that are being preserved. And what I got excited about the film when I first saw it and talked to David about it, what made really a lot of sense to me was that it presents it in a non-judgmental way, and it allows people to just be themselves in that way that once people understand it, they maybe will tend to support it and its continuation.
There's a sense that one gets seeing this film of northern New Mexico as, I mean, you've got people talking, and yet there's a kind of nonverbal sense about the whole thing. Sometimes
right.
even as they're talking, maybe they're searching for words, and what I felt was it's about land, it's about the things you do, and not the way you talk.
Exactly. And that part, that is the beauty of northern New Mexico. As you know, you've lived here so long, and you have a real feel for it. And I was thinking the other day about that discussion we had about bilingos, you know, and the use of the language.
Mixing Spanish and English.
Spanish and English,
right.
Yeah. But the whole deal is that there is something to be honored in this civilization in northern New Mexico. And as David was saying, it pulls people in. And what I felt when I saw the film was this memory. It just took me back to the things that I grew up with. And it seems a little bit, you know, funny sometimes to talk about, well, when I was, you know, walking uphill both ways and things like that. It isn't just that type of memory or making the past always better. It is a way of life that was gentle, and that people, when they come to New Mexico, and they, as my view now, when they experience it and don't try to mold it to their own way, they embrace it.
Yeah.
They become part of it, and they accept that way of being.
Well, I think so many of us have, I mean, I remember consciously the day I made the decision to move here, which was over 20 years ago. I realized that the way of life that I was living in a city back east was grinding me down. And I didn't want to be ground down. I wanted to be basically standing up and going through my day
right.
without being utterly and completely exhausted by the end of every single day. And this is a place where you can do that because the pace of life is perhaps more in tune with nature because we're in it more. I mean, I don't want to sound like a cliche.
No, I think about that a lot. I think that you have the opportunity to imagine yourself or even feel like you're part of nature in a place that's so interesting.
Which, in fact, we are.
Yeah.
That's right. Tourism department, as you know, Mary Charlotte, has just come up with a new program promoting northern New Mexico, well, New Mexico entirely. And one of the things, I was just at a presentation of that yesterday, and I got to see what they're doing with their new ads, but they're talking about adventure, they're talking about experience, they're talking about authenticity, they're talking about culture, all of these things that have permeated the discussion. And it isn't about, you know, alien beings in down in Roswell, although that's part of the New Mexico overall. But in northern New Mexico in particular, there is this focus on experience of the land, experience of the people, experience of just being. And
And that's fine for tourism, but there's also something, as we're talking about it, as you experienced, David, as somebody who grew up here and then went away, there's something that you don't get quickly. There's something that seeps into you over time.
Yeah, I just always thought it was embarrassing to say how much you like the Jemez Mountains or something like that. And then all of a sudden, well, when we made this film, it was just clear that everybody is waiting for a chance to express how much they like their culture or where they're from. Here, I don't know that you would say, you know, the same thing about I really like the, you know, 57th and 10th Avenue in New York City. Maybe you would. I don't know. But it's because of the
yeah, maybe.
The natural beauty and the connection that many people have to the land in one way or another. And we're a rural place, and I love cities too, but this was a real opportunity to celebrate something that was just so beautiful.
The film is called Land, Water, People, Time by David Lindblom. Anything you want to let people know before we go?
Well, it was great to come back to New Mexico at a time when there was a lot of filmmaking going on. And Danny Valerio and Cynthia Jeanette Gomez and I were sort of met each other through the higher, you know, there was a lot of filmmaking, not so much right maybe today, but a couple of years ago. So we met each other and we started in on this film together. And in a way, Danny kind of opened the doors to come back and find something in film to do. And I'm just so grateful to that. And then Cynthia is embarking on a project about the Jinicero tribe, I guess you'd say.
It's a very interesting story, which we can't go into now, but you should see it.
She should be your next guest. There's going forward and there's going back in history. And
but you'll see, if people who see the film will see some of the history.
Yeah.
Once again, it will be screening this Friday, the 15th of June, at El Museo Cultural, which is right here in Santa Fe, near the Santa Fe Rail Yard. And there's a reception from 6 to 6:30. And then the film is screening at 6:30, and then there will be time for question and answers, and then just a discussion afterwards. It's a whole evening in collaboration with the Northern Rio Grande National Heritage Area, of which Tom Romero is executive director. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
This is great.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Arup Mangalik. He is a physician at the University of New Mexico Cancer Center, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore this Sunday, the 17th of June at 11 in the morning, in a conversation called My Life, My Death, My Choice, Doctors Push for Death with Dignity. He'll be there with Dr. Catherine Morris in conversation with attorney Peter White. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, you are speaking not as a member of the University of New Mexico Cancer Center, but as an individual, as a doctor working for so many years with dying patients. Why have you come to support this Death with Dignity movement? First of all, what is this movement, and why have you come to support it?
The movement is is geared towards allowing patients who are suffering from a terminal illness and who do not have any option in regard to controlling their disease. It has been established through their physician that they have a terminal illness and are not likely to survive for more than 6 months. If such a patient feels that they would like to have their death at a time of their choosing rather than suffering through the whole period, we are requesting that this be made a legal process. And the way it is proceeding is that the current law in New Mexico states that assisting somebody to commit suicide is a felony. What we are requesting the courts in New Mexico to clarify is that such a law should not apply to a physician who prescribes a lethal dose of a drug to a patient who is mentally competent and is terminally ill. And that it would be, if the patient requests that, the prescription can be given without fear of prosecution. It is up to the patient to request the drug. It is for the patient to fill the prescription, and it is for the patient to take the prescription. And it is up to the physician to prescribe it. No physician is being obligated to give the prescription if they don't feel comfortable with that.
You have worked as an oncologist at the University of New Mexico Cancer Center. You must have seen just terribly painful end-of-life situations. What does that look like to you? I mean, is it just horrible suffering, the end of a person's consciousness, and they just want to leave? I mean, what does it look like?
Yeah, that is the problem which we face with not all patients, but some patients. Many patients with the normal doses of pain medication or other problem which they may have, we can control those symptoms with medications or other measures. But in some patients, those measures are not effective. And in order to relieve those patients of their suffering, we are requesting for this clarification of the law.
So the New Mexico law makes it a felony for a doctor to prescribe a lethal dose of medication that the patient wants?
No, the New Mexico law just states that it is illegal and a felony to assist somebody in committing suicide. So we are saying that we feel that that provision of the law, that general statement in the law, should not apply to a physician who prescribes the lethal dose in these circumstances.
To what extent, I was wondering this, do patients, for example, who know that their time has come and they would like to leave their very suffering bodies, to what extent do they just take it upon themselves, for example, to get a sleeping pill prescription and then overdose on it?
That is something which is being done, but it is done surreptitiously. For the patient, say the patient asks for a sleeping pill or a pain pill, and then stores the pain pills and takes them all at one time. And that is what some patients do. But we are hoping that rather than the patient feeling guilty and doing something which is surreptitious, they do it openly and with full understanding. And that is the big difference. And I may extend this to another point, that very often we do use a procedure which is not really a procedure, but a method which we often call palliative sedation or terminal sedation, in which we say that we will give you enough pain medication that you go into a coma as a result of the pain medication. So we are, again, trying to do a double-faced statement. We don't say it is to kill you, but de facto, that also will kill the patient. And we feel that it should be done openly and without any guilt or feeling of doing something underhand.
You are from India.
Correct.
How are these issues handled, or how were they handled when you were a young person? Somebody was suffering, they were at the end of their lives. What did they do?
In the traditional Indian culture and in Indian society, and I practiced medicine in India for about 15 years before I came to the U.S., there the family was more accepting, and morphine and other drugs were available more easily than they are in this country. So many patients did take an overdose and ended their life in that fashion. But ironically, as more and more Western medicine has come into India, there are more, I could go back to India regularly, and I hear more and more stories of patients and doctors both coming away from that and trying to do treatments at the end of life, which everyone appreciates and recognizes would not be helpful in terms of controlling their disease. But we keep many more than before, many doctors are now using those kinds of treatments. And the openness with which patients allowed themselves to die or kill themselves is getting less frequent.
We're talking to Dr. Arup Mangalik. When there are cases where somebody is in a state of either in a coma or in a state where they can't make choices for themselves anymore because they're hooked up to machines or respirators or things like that, what are the choices that the patient or the patient's family has at that point? Is this part of the conversation that you're engaged in right now in terms of dying with dignity?
That is a separate situation, because we are confining this current initiative, we are restricting it to patients who are fully competent, fully capable of expressing themselves, but have a terminal illness. Once the patient gets to a situation when they are hooked up to machines and things of that type, then this particular initiative would not work. I have, over the last 15 years or so, tried to increase the consciousness of the public and the medical profession to be more clear about the situation of, you know, patient being on a machine, and say, hey, we should not put this patient on a machine in the first place, or stop the use of the respirators and so on once it is clear that the treatment that we are using is not going to work. But that becomes a little more complicated, because there are multiple people involved and the situation is very complex. Here we are looking at a very clear situation of a competent patient with a terminal illness, but the patient is very capable of expressing themselves at this time.
We're talking to Dr. Arup Mangalik. How do your doctor and nurse colleagues feel about this issue? Do they feel the way that you do, by and large, or is there a lot of division about that?
I have not conducted a formal survey, but I will explain this a little bit. I sent out to the community in the Health Sciences Center, expressing my opinions. And I got back approximately 50 responses, all of which were positive. There were two responses where the person recognized the importance of this initiative, but felt that from their belief systems, they could not support it, because they felt that the intent to kill was not acceptable to them. They were comfortable with the current situation of giving an overdose, but not with the intent of killing. I have not had anybody actively state that I'm being, I'm trying to kill people unnecessarily.
Does that tend to be grounded in religious belief or an innate moral sense or what?
I think, no, I should say, I think I know because they said so. Both these people felt that their religious belief did not allow them to give the dose with the intent of killing. They were comfortable with the intent of relieving pain and in the process, the patient dying. And that's a distinction which was very important to them. And to me, the intent of killing versus the side effect of dying are pretty much the same. I feel that if the patient needs that, we should go ahead and do it openly. And that is the distinction.
Have you observed what's happening in Oregon? In other words, that's a place where they've passed a death with dignity law, and every year maybe 100 people make use of that. What do you get back from that state? How's that going as a policy?
As a policy, I have heard many statements, and my assessment is that it is a very positively, the whole initiative is looked at positively. Initially, of course, there were some objections, but now don't seem to be any objections because people have realized that this is between the patient and the physician, and that, and in fact, in Oregon, they have to have two physicians meet the patient twice. But either way, they have realized that nobody is being forced into this in any way, and therefore it has been accepted. And actually, Washington State also has passed a similar law.
This sounds crazy, but I have, for years, being a dog owner, been struck by what seems to me like the superiority of veterinary care over human care. You can walk into a clinic and get care same mm-hmm. day. You can get diagnostics and treatment that are excellent. You can get doctors who are cooperating with each other. And at the end of an animal's life, the doctor and the pet owner can make that decision to put the animal out of its suffering. And nobody seems to object to that. Why the double standard? Do we not see ourselves as animals like everybody else really is?
That is something which I also have a very hard time understanding because I have seen patients, families insisting on treatments, especially when the patient is unable to speak. And they see the patient is suffering. They are informed by the physicians clearly that there is no treatment that is going to work. But for some reason, and I do not understand that, for some reason, the family insists on doing what is, commonly used the phrase, everything. And what I say is, why not do everything to make the patient comfortable?
Right.
But somehow that does not, there are certain groups of people for whom this reality does not agree. They don't agree with this reality.
And there seems in that attitude to be a denial of the inevitability of death and an unwillingness to let go when somebody is at the end of their life.
That is correct. There, some people make the comment that Americans think death is optional, which is a very crude way of putting it, but that's what it seems like in some situations. And some situations are tragic. If you have a healthy young person who very rapidly gets into a bad situation for whatever reason and is dying, people want to do everything they can to keep that person alive. And they lose sight track of the reality that nothing can be done for situations. Other things which have been stated, which I personally have not seen, is that certain religious groups and certain ethnic groups feel that they are being discriminated against, and therefore the doctors are not giving them the treatment. So it is those kinds of phenomena that, or perceptions, I should say, which lead to this tragedy of patients suffering rather than being with their family and holding hands and, you know, being comfortable when they are dying.
Now, there's another factor, an economic factor, namely that often a very large amount of a patient's lifetime medical costs get spent in the last couple of weeks of their life.
That is correct.
And some of this is just the kind of thing you're talking about. It's basically putting off the inevitable and prolonging suffering. Do you think that economics is or should be a part of this conversation?
Yes, it should. But economics is that patients think that because they have insurance and or Medicare or something of that type, that they will not have to, the family particularly, that they, because they have coverage, they will not have any payments to make. Reality, unfortunately, is that there are co-payments, and many a family is stuck with a very large bill because they did not think the whole problem issue through. There is again in the group which is opposed to comfort at death, they have this perception that doctors would not treat a patient because it will cost the hospital money. The reality is that regardless of whether you have insurance or not, the hospitals will treat, and through various kinds of coverage, indigent care, even if you don't have insurance, the hospital gets paid. So the doctors actually make money when the patients are treated heavily at the end of their life. It is the patient who suffers both in terms of physical problems and also suffers financially.
Having seen what you have seen, do you know what kind of choices you would make for yourself at the end of your life?
Yeah, I have discussed this with my friends, my son, who's my heir, and he lives in a different town. So, I mean, I've also discussed it with my friends in Albuquerque and my colleagues, and everybody knows that I would not like to be kept on a machine. If it was, even if it was a short-term, procedure to tide me over a crisis, that's different. But not to keep me alive if I have a serious terminal illness, then be with me, hold my hand, talk to me, and let me die. They all understand that. Can I tell a joke here?
Yes.
One time I was in a meeting with, in a discussion meeting with my colleagues. And I got a coughing spell. And all the people around me started shouting, hospice, hospice. So people know my wishes.
Dr. Arup Mangalik is a physician at the University of New Mexico Cancer Center. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And once again, Dr. Mangalik will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Sunday morning, June 17th at 11 o'clock, in a discussion titled My Life, My Death, My Choice, Doctors Push for Death with Dignity. And that will be along with Dr. Catherine Morris in conversation with attorney Peter White. For more information, you can call Collected Works Bookstore at 988-4226. I'd like now to welcome Michelle Goodman. She's the manager of the Tool Lending Library at the Habitat for Humanity Restore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So the Habitat for Humanity Restore is a place where you can buy all sorts of things that people have donated, building materials and objects and appliances and all kinds of things. But little did most of us know, they also have a tool lending library where for very nominal fees, you can rent tools, carpentry tools, all sorts of things, take them home and build whatever you want to and then bring them back.
That's right.
How does it work?
For, as you say, a nominal fee, we, and two forms of ID, you live in Santa Fe County, you can become a member of the library. You don't rent the tools, you borrow them.
Oh, okay.
And that list that
I
you're looking at.
I have a price list with prices on it.
The prices are late fees. They're not prices for the tools. The tools are free, and if you can stay within the time limit, then there are no other charges than $10 a year.
Now, how... It's a week that you get the tools for?
Right. One power tool and four hand tools at a time for a week.
So is it something that a lot of people are using?
We almost have signed up 500 people in 2 years.
Uh-huh. And so they come and borrow things and then come back with pictures and show you what they've built.
Sometimes, if I'm lucky, they do. It's pretty great. People who are doing projects, who know about tools and just don't necessarily have the big tools anymore, or who don't know anything. We also have a library of books, of how-to books that you can take out. And you can do gardening or plumbing or tile set. We have a tile saw, carpentry tools, as you said. There are all kinds of things that people are up to when they're borrowing tools.
Do you talk to them about how to do some of the projects? Do they come to you with questions?
Sometimes. It's not really my place to advise. We plan on having classes eventually for how to, but we haven't started that yet. And if I know or have an idea about what their question is, I'll talk to them about it. And we have volunteers who know more than I do, and they... So I work in the ReStore and I oversee the tool library, but we also have volunteers who are actually there dealing with customers, and so sometimes they can be very helpful with whatever it is. Often people know what they want and what they're going to do with it. So it's
such a great idea, because I mean there are rental places, but just for things like a straight edge and a chisel and things like that.
That's
the
right.
fact that you can go borrow those things for a few days is so awesome.
Well, and some people have, it is awesome. And some people have donated tools and then borrow them.
That's
really.
Great. That's it a great
is,
idea.
It is fabulous. Then we store them. Lots of people get to use them. And it works for everybody. You know, so people in the library are really great about, it's very supportive of the library. Sometimes things will get broken, they'll go online, order the piece, bring it in, and then I have a volunteer also who repairs tools, and so he'll put it back together.
Now, what happens if you take something home and just break it?
Well... Then often they talk to me or they talk to the volunteer about how it happened. Usually people are really good about saying whether it was their fault or if the tool just broke.
But I mean, more if it was their fault. Do they have to replace it?
It's, it's a lot easier than that. I mean, looser than that. We do have very, in our borrowing rules, there are very strict rules about all of that, it's said that they have to replace it. But most of our tools, I would say 95%, have been donated. They were donated to the ReStore or directly to the library. And so they're already a little bit used. Often they're pretty new, but sometimes they're used. And so I'm not going to make somebody pay for something that was used and would be on its way out, you know. If it's something that I haven't had the truth is I haven't had the experience where something that was in really good shape got broken because someone was negligent.
So what you're talking about is a community of responsible, nice people.
I would say 99% yes.
We're talking to Michelle Goodman about the Tool Lending Library at the Habitat for Humanity ReStore. What if people would like to either donate tools or volunteer time or anything like that?
Oh, thank you for asking. The library, and a very important thing to know, the library is open Monday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Okay. From 9 to 5.
From 9 to 5, just like the store. And it's very important to know that you can only take out and bring back tools on those days. And we have some volunteers who oversee the service, but we always need more. We need more to people to sit and talk, to do customer service or do inventory or any number of other things. So that would be a way to help. The other way to help is to donate tools. A lot of times people have doubles of something, or they just don't use their tools anymore. We've had contractors come in and donate tools to us that they use their whole lives and
wow.
You know, their working
lives. And they're retiring.
It can be really poignant.
You should have a ceremony or something.
I know. And I have collections also of very old tools that somebody has had forever from, you know, their grandfather had or whoever, and I keep them often, even though we don't necessarily lend them out. But if they can't be used in the library, they can be used in the store as a donation, and the proceeds go to help build houses for Habitat for Humanity.
Now, what if people have, for example, cans of paint and things like that, which are still good and a little bit has been used? Can they donate things like that? I mean, those aren't tools.
No, but we take lots of donations. It so happens that we don't take paint. We've stopped taking paint, so that's an important thing to know, that we don't take paint. But other kinds of building materials and furniture, lighting, plumbing, sinks, any of that kind of thing, we would love to have in the store, so that those proceeds, as I said, go to Habitat for Humanity.
The stuff that comes in, does it tend to turn around pretty quickly, or do you have stuff that's sort of languishing there for years? Or
Not years. No, we don't. It moves faster than that. Or we move it out in some other way, either take it apart and take it to scrap, or we recycle it in some way. But it does move pretty quickly unless we have something that people just don't want anymore, you know, and in which case it hangs around for a little bit and then we get...
What are things like that?
Well, there's some kinds of lighting that people don't...
Oh, because it's dated.
And it's not old enough to be really cool.
Right.
But it's not new enough to be really cool.
Right.
So it just sits.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Are there other tool lending libraries like this?
Absolutely. There are approximately 30 tool lending libraries in the country. Some of them have been around for 25, 30 years. There's one in Berkeley, one in Ohio that have been around for 25 years, and some are only two others connected to the ReStore. They all operate differently on some level, but with the same concept of lending tools. It's a great program, really.
It's just another way of doing community.
That's exactly right. It's a great community service, and people are thrilled about it. And so I hope people will come and take advantage.
Excellent. Michelle Goodman is manager of the Tool Lending Library at the Habitat for Humanity ReStore, and it's open Monday, Thursday, and Saturday from 9 to 5. It's at 2414 Cerrillos Road. And the phone number over there is 473-1114. Where is that on Cerrillos?
Well, it's where the old Hastings was, on Cerrillos next to
Near Smith Supermarket.
That's exactly right.
Michelle Goodman, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.